Hi, this is Brian, and we are reading The Hill for Tuesday, December 23rd. The story, Republicans divided on whether Trump should topple Venezuela's Maduro with military force. Republican lawmakers are divided over whether President Trump should escalate military pressure on Venezuela to oust President Nicolas Maduro, with some Republicans warning that regime change has a history of backfiring on the United States. Senate Republicans largely support Trump's aggressive targeting of Venezuelan speedboats suspected of smuggling drugs, but some warn that attacking Maduro's regime more directly, either by striking targets on land or putting boots on the ground, could go too far. I'm certainly following the situation closely. I support what the president's done. I think the question is how forceful we should do this, said Senator Roger Marshall, Republican of Kansas. I think we just have to be very careful when we're dealing with regime change. It seems to backfire a lot. Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, said he believes the administration is pursuing regime change in Venezuela and declared, "I'm opposed to it." Paul argued that Trump is being arbitrary in striking Venezuelan boats suspected of drug smuggling, while pardoning the former president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was sentenced to 45 years in prison for partnering with cocaine traffickers to smuggle drugs into the United States. Trump pardoned Hernandez earlier this month. They let go of a guy that was in prison for 40 years at a very high level, distributing narcotics, and then they're blowing up these other people. It's the whole danger of what we've gotten away from is, at one point in time, Congress was supposed to declare war under the Constitution. We've gotten away from that, Paul said. Paul said that presidents are getting around Congress's authority to declare war by themselves, declaring war against people we designate to be terrorists. Now they're designating the government terrorists, he said. Tensions in the region increased over the weekend when the U.S. Coast Guard attempted to intercept an oil tanker headed toward Venezuela to pick up a shipment of crude oil. U.S. forces have already seized two oil tankers off the coast of Venezuela amid a massive buildup of U.S. naval forces in the Caribbean Sea aimed at putting pressure on Maduro. A Republican senator who requested anonymity to comment frankly on Trump's aggressive pressure against Maduro, said the Trump administration seems intent on ousting Maduro, even though Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth and Secretary of State Marco Rubio told senators in a briefing last week that's not their goal. I do not want to put ground troops in Venezuela. I don't want to have another Afghanistan or Iraq, the senator said. I'm not in favor of U.S.-directed regime change. Rubio last week addressed Senate Republicans' growing concerns that Trump may be planning a more aggressive intervention in Venezuela to oust the Maduro regime, which many Republicans say has held onto power illegitimately. Marco said repeatedly that regime change is not the policy of the United States. It was not the focus of the anti-narco-trafficking policy, the senator said. Several other senators confirmed that Rubio assured lawmakers on Capitol Hill during a classified briefing that the administration is not pursuing regime change, but those claims were undercut by comments White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles made to journalist Chris Whipple in an interview for Vanity Fair, indicating that regime change in Venezuela is Trump's goal. He wants to keep on blowing up boats up until Maduro cries uncle, Wiles said, and suggested that if Trump wants to order land strikes, he would need Congress's authority. Senate Appropriations Committee Chair Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, says there's a lack of clarity from the administration about its national security goals for the region. The briefing helped somewhat, but there's still a lack of clarity, aside from the drug issue, of why we're involved in this country's leadership, she said. I don't have clear understanding, she said. Trump said last month that U.S. strikes against Venezuela could begin very soon, a threat that prompted Paul to join a group of Senate Democrats to file a war powers resolution to block U.S. armed forces from engaging in hostilities against Venezuela without authorization from Congress. Democratic Senators Tim Kaine of Virginia, Adam Schiff of California, and Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York are leading co-sponsors of the measure with Paul. Only two House Republicans, Representatives Don Bacon of Nebraska and Thomas Massey of Kentucky, voted last week in favor of a Democratic resolution to stop hostilities against any presidentially designated terrorist organization in the Western Hemisphere without authorization from Congress. Some Republican defense hawks have expressed frustration that Rubio and Hegseth haven't stated more clearly an agenda to force Maduro from power. Most Americans want to know what's going to happen next. I want to know what's going to happen next. Is it the policy to take Maduro down? It should be, if it's not. And if he goes, what's going to happen next? I'd like a better answer as to what happens when Maduro goes, said Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, an outspoken advocate for regime change, after meeting with Hegseth and Rubio. The prospect of expanded military operations against Venezuela poses thorny questions for MAGA allied conservatives who have warned against the United States becoming enmeshed in endless wars. Senator Lucinthia Loomis, Republican of Wyoming, who considers herself aligned with the America First movement, said she's usually skeptical of U.S. military interventions aimed at regime change, but supports Trump's pressure on Venezuela to combat drug trafficking. I do tend to look askance at more international engagements, but I also have a drug-addicted nephew who's in prison, and I've seen what these drugs are doing to America, and it's terrifying, she said. Maduro is part of that narco-terrorism. I think it's appropriate to call it narco-terrorism, and I'm actually okay with it all, she said, arguing that Maduro was not illegitimately reelected. I don't know that I would support U.S. boots on the crime to accomplish regime change, but I'm very hopeful that it will happen regardless, she said. Senator Eric Schmidt, Republican of Missouri, a staunch Trump ally, said he believes the president is focused on stopping Venezuelan drug smuggling boats and declined to speculate on whether Maduro needs to be toppled to effectively stop the flow of drugs from his country. Clearly, Maduro is part of these cartel rings, but right now the focus is to blow the boats that are killing Americans out of the water, he said. The story, U.S. military kills narco-terrorist in Eastern Pacific strike. The U.S. military struck an alleged drug trafficking boat in the Eastern Pacific Ocean on Monday, killing one narco-terrorist. U.S. Southern Command, or SOUTHCOM, shared a 27-second video of the strike on X, adding that the vessel was operated by designated terrorist organizations in international waters and was transiting along known narco-trafficking routes in the Eastern Pacific. No U.S. military forces were injured in the latest operations, SOUTHCOM noted. The U.S. military has now conducted a minimum of 27 strikes on alleged drug trafficking vessels in the Eastern Pacific and Caribbean Sea since early September, killing at least 105 people. The Pentagon has alleged that the boats were carrying drugs headed for the U.S. The strikes have come under increased scrutiny on Capitol Hill, particularly after the military confirmed that it conducted a follow-up strike that killed two survivors during its initial September 2 operation. The operations have also ramped up tensions with Venezuela and its leader, Nicolas Maduro, whom the Trump administration has dubbed an illegitimate leader. The administration alleges that Maduro is the head of a drug trafficking terrorist organization. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and Secretary of State Marco Rubio briefed lawmakers on the strikes last week. After the briefing, Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, said that the two cabinet officials admitted that intelligence suggests that the accused drug boats are smuggling cocaine, not fentanyl, and were en route to Europe, not the U.S. The story, Trump's successor race gears up in wake of MAGA turning point tiffs. The race to succeed President Trump is gearing up following Turning Point USA CEO Erica Kirk's endorsement of Vice President J.D. Vance, marking one of the first major endorsements ahead of the 2028 Republican primary. Kirk's backing of Vance, who has not announced whether he is running in 2028, is likely to hold sway given the organization's influence among conservatives. Vance is widely viewed as an heir apparent to Trump, but some cracks have formed within MAGA world over just who would take the reins of the movement as the vice president sought to strike a unifying tone while addressing America Fest over the weekend. Aside from who might lead to next Republican presidential race, infighting also arose over how to handle free speech and bigotry, suggesting the next leader in the party may face even more obstacles about how far to go in terms of embracing conspiracy theories and other controversial figures. Besides Vance, there are, it seems, a number of other potential Trump successors who have been throwing elbows. They include Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, Republican, and the president's own son, Donald Trump Jr. Trump himself has not named a successor and hasn't thrown his weight fully behind a single potential candidate in Rubio or Vance, teasing that one or both could be on the 2028 ticket. Some Republicans, in turn, have backed a competitive presidential primary. I think it's very important that the Republican Party have a competitive primary, former White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany told Fox News last week. A hypothetical 2028 Republican primary poll conducted by Atlas Intel showed Vance leading the field with 47% support, followed by Rubio at 23% and DeSantis at 13% support. Meanwhile, Vance dominated Turning Point USA's 2028 straw poll with 84.2% support. Rubio came in second with 4.8% support, followed by DeSantis at 2.9%. Trump Jr. came in at 1.8%, while Cruz garnered 0.3%. Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, Republican, came in at 0.4%. Another 2.5% of respondents said they were undecided, and 3.1% said someone else. Republican strategist Ford O'Connell said Kirk's endorsement of Vance made sense from their perspective, given that Vance's advantages in being seen as a potential heir apparent to Trump. This is smart by TPUSA because they're getting in on the ground floor with the person who's most likely to be the nominee, O'Connell said. Vance and Rubio have brushed off talks of any potential 2028 rivalry between the two of them. Meanwhile, the vice president and his allies have repeatedly maintained that he is focused squarely on defending the GOP's majorities in both chambers of Congress next year. The VP is immensely grateful for the support of Erica and the entire Turning Point team. It's tremendous, one source close to the vice president told The Hill. But politically, he's entirely committed to the midterms and won't make a decision about 2028 until after Election Day, the source continued. That's why his speech focused on rallying the base around what the administration has achieved to date and what's at stake if Republicans lose either or both houses of Congress. We cannot exhaust ourselves in fighting when there's so much at stake, the source said, referring to the vice president's address at the Turning Point conference on Sunday. Others viewed Vance's remarks as a unity speech that sounded like it could have come from someone vying to play the role of a GOP flag bearer. I appreciate the spin because you have to say that spin, but the 2028 race is already well underway, said one Republican strategist. 2026 is just going to help color it a bit, the strategist added. Next year's campaign trail will provide Vance with an opportunity to boost his national profile while touting his role in the Trump administration and has someone who can carry on the torch. They're focused on the House, not 2028, because if you don't focus on that, then 2028 gathers less importance because the idea is that you're electing Vance in the way they elected H.W. to carry on the trajectory, O'Connell said, referring to former President George H.W. Bush's 1988 presidential victory. Because if you lose the House, the trajectory stops outside of executive orders, O'Connell added. Despite Bush's win, Democrats maintained their majorities in the House and Senate that same year. Only four sitting vice presidents, including Bush, have been elected president in U.S. history. And if history is any indicator, the Trump administration and their Republican allies will face an uphill climb in next year's midterms. A sitting president's party has historically underperformed in the first midterm elections of their administration. Additionally, a slew of recent polls show growing frustrations with the Trump administration, particularly on the economy. According to a CBS News YouGov poll released on Sunday, only 18% of respondents said they believe Trump's policies are making them better off financially. Another 45% said Trump's policies will worsen their financial situation in 2026. Still, there are hopeful signs for Republicans. The latest polling average from The Hill and Decision Desk HQ found that Trump's approval rating has actually rebounded from previous lows this year. Trump's approval rating in the DDHQ average of polls stands at 44.8%, marking a 3.5-point increase from last month. Vance has seen his approval rating improve in the polling average as well, ticking up from around 44% in November to just over 45% this month. Republicans argue they are hopeful that trend will continue, assuming Trump and Vance each hit the campaign trail in 2026. Vance gave a preview of what to expect from him on the trail when he touted Trump's efforts to bring inflation down during an event in Battleground, Pennsylvania earlier this month. Despite Vance being best positioned at the moment to take over where Trump leaves off, those in his orbit say he would be all for a competitive 2028 primary. If he chooses to run, he knows there's not going to be a coronation. Nobody wants that, said the source close to the vice president. The more the merrier. The story: Newsom, Vance lead wide open 2028 field. California Governor Gavin Newsom, Democrat, and Vice President Vance topped their respective parties' lists of potential 2028 presidential contenders, according to a new CNN poll. In the survey, two-thirds of American respondents said they don't have a specific person in mind that they'd like to see run for president in 2028, while 16% mentioned a Republican or conservative name they'd like to see run. 14% mentioned a Democrat or liberal name, 2% named a nonpartisan individual or provided attributes of their preferred candidate, and 1% opted not to name their preferred candidate. More than half of the 16% of respondents within a GOP candidate in mind named the vice president, 11% named Vance, 2% named Secretary of State Marco Rubio, 1% named President Trump, and 1% named Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. No other conservative name was mentioned by more than 1% of respondents. Newsom topped the Democrats' list but didn't garner the same unified support that Vance did within the GOP. The 14% of respondents who named a Democrat they'd like to see run for president included 6% who named Newsom, 3% who named former Vice President Kamala Harris, and 2% who named Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York. Other liberal-leaning 2028 contenders named by 1% of survey respondents were former Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, former President Obama, former First Lady Michelle Obama, and Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona. Numerous other candidates were mentioned, but none managed to clinch at least a full percentage point. The survey is consistent with other 2028 polls, ranking top candidates suspected of mounting bids in the next presidential cycle. While the Democratic field remains wide open, GOP enthusiasm has zeroed in on Vance as heir apparent to succeed Trump and run atop the White House ticket in 2028. Turning Point USA CEO Erica Kirk announced Thursday that she is endorsing Vance for president in 2028. Vance has not said whether he would run for president next cycle, but has left the door open to the possibility. I've thought about what the moment might look like after the midterm elections, sure, but I also, whenever I think about that, I try to put it out of my head and remind myself the American people elected to do a job right now, and my job is to do it, Vance told Fox News' Sean Hannity in an interview last month when asked if he had thought about running for president. We're going to do everything that we can to win the midterms, and then after that I'm going to sit down with the President of the United States and talk to him about it, he added. Newsom similarly has not announced a 2028 bid, but confirmed he's thinking about it when asked if it's fair to say after the 2026 midterms you're going to give it a serious thought. Yeah, I'd be lying otherwise, Newsom said in an interview with CBS News in October. I'd just be lying, and I'm not. I can't do that. The survey, conducted December 4 through 7, includes 1,032 respondents and has a margin of error of 3.5 percentage points. The story, lawmakers hammered DOJ over Epstein files release. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are tangling over potential consequences for Department of Justice or DOJ officials after the department failed to share every document tied to the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein as required under law. Representatives Thomas Massie, Republican of Kentucky, and Ro Khanna, Democrat of California, the bipartisan duo who led the effort to force a vote on the bill to release the files, are launching an inherent contempt to push for Attorney General Pam Bondi, threatening to fine her until the full tranche is released. Khanna went further, suggesting the delayed and incomplete release could even be grounds for impeachment. But while the bill to release the files garnered near unanimous support in Congress, lawmakers may splinter on how aggressively to push back on the DOJ. Khanna argued that the delayed release of the files has only fueled frustration among Epstein victims and MAGA supporters, suggesting they could secure backing for weighty consequences. Impeachment is a political decision, and is there the support in the House of Representatives? I mean, Massie and I aren't going to just do something for the show of it, but my sense is, just looking at the initial reactions from people in MAGA, from survivors, is that this release is going to cause as much grief for Pam Bondi as the earlier releases. Susie Wiles said she whiffed. This isn't building more trust, Khanna told CNN's Caitlin Collins on Friday. The law passed by Congress allows for redactions to protect victims, but it otherwise gave the DOJ 30 days to publicly share all unclassified records related to Epstein. That set the deadline for December 19, last Friday. Even before DOJ released a partial tranche, however, Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche set off a firestorm by announcing the department wouldn't be sharing the full files, telling Fox News that the volume of information was simply too large for attorneys to redact victim identities within the 30-day deadline. Blanche said the department would release several hundred thousand documents on Friday, and then over the next couple weeks, I expect several hundred thousand more. That pushed Representatives Robert Garcia of California and Jamie Raskin of Maryland, the top Democrats on the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee and Judiciary Committee, respectively, to say they would be examining all legal options to force the DOJ to comply with the law. And Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, on Monday introduced legislation that would direct the Senate to initiate legal action against the DOJ for failing to meet the deadline. But even among congressional Democrats and a few Republicans who have highlighted the Epstein files, there have been questions about how far to go. Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia, called both impeachment and inherent contempt conversations premature. During a Sunday appearance on NBC's Meet the Press, we have tools in appropriations bills and other tools to force compliance if somebody is dragging their feet, and I'd rather focus on those tools than get into discussions about contempt and impeachment, he added. When asked about the intermediate step of seeking inherent contempt for Bondi, House Minority Whip Catherine Clark, Democrat of Massachusetts, sidestepped whether she would back the move even as she hammered DOJ. Time is up. They signed this law. They knew where fines were, and they've missed them. And we have two concerns here. One is that we need justice for the survivors, and second is we need this White House and the Department of Justice to comply with the law, Clark said during an appearance on CNN. So we are going to consider all options and what we can do as members of Congress to make sure that they release these full documents. The time for excuses has ended. Others, however, have been more forceful. Progressive firebrand Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, called for Bondi to resign after CBS News reported that a 119-page document labeled Grand Jury NY was entirely redacted. The outlet reported that three other consecutive documents totaling 255 pages were also entirely redacted. Now the cover-up is out in the open. This is far from over, she wrote on the social platform X last Friday. Everyone involved will have to answer for this. Pam Bondi, Kash Patel, whole admin, protecting a bunch of rapists and pedophiles because they have money, power, and connections. Bondi should resign tonight. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, the top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, said he will investigate why DOJ failed to comply with the deadline. Yesterday could have been a win for survivors, accountability, and transparency to the public. It wasn't. After mishandling the Epstein files all year, the Trump administration is now violating federal law to protect the rich and powerful, he said in a Saturday statement. It took an act of Congress to force Pam Bondi, Kash Patel, and Dan Bongino to even consider providing justices. They had a choice, survivors or Donald Trump. They chose the latter. Senate Judiciary Democrats will investigate this violation of law and make sure the American people know about it. President Trump has repeatedly insisted he has nothing to hide regarding the Epstein files, dismissing calls for their release as a Democratic hoax. However, the Department of Justice faced backlash over the weekend after at least 15 photos included in the files, including a photo that contained images of Trump, disappeared from the department's website. The photograph was later restored. Representative Tim Burkett, Republican of Tennessee, who's previously advocated for clarity and transparency on the Epstein files, told NewsNation's Chris Cuomo last week that the Department of Justice is a multi-leveled onion and argued that you're never going to get to the bottom of this thing, Chris. It's just like the Kennedy assassination. I wish people would understand, though, there's a group of people out there that are in this, involved in this, that don't want their names released, and there is some protection within the writing of the law, but you're correct in every one of your assumptions where you said that, you know, who goes after the Justice Department when they screw up, he said. I mean, it's like, no, nobody goes after the Justice Department, and I think that's inherently what's wrong with this, the way they passed this thing and what they passed. They should have had a clause in there for punishment for refusing to do that, cutting off funds, doing something Congress is the checkbook. We should have done that, cut off their freaking money, he added. The pushback isn't coming from within Congress. A group of Epstein survivors on Monday penned an open letter blasting DOJ for clear-cut violations of an unambiguous law and encouraging congressional oversight. This law, enacted by a nearly unanimous vote in the House and unanimously in the Senate and signed by the President, was clear. It afforded no permission for delayed disclosure, a group of 18 survivors wrote in the letter. We call upon Congress to stand up for the rule of law. We urge immediate congressional oversight, including hearings, formal demands for compliance, and legal action to ensure the Department of Justice fulfills its legal obligations. Blanche also appeared on Meet the Press on Sunday, said he does not take the impeachment threats or criticism seriously, defending the delay as part of the need to protect victims. He said the need to comply with other laws, like redacting information, that very much trumps the need to meet the deadline in the statute. Blanche also said the photos that were removed were done so amid questions over whether they contained sensitive information about victims. When we hear from victims' rights groups about this type of photograph, we put it down and investigate, he said. Though he said additional documents would be released in the coming weeks, Blanche did not give a more specific timeline for when all the files would be released, nor did he seem concerned about potential action against the department. Bring it on, he said, of impeachment threats. We are doing everything we're supposed to be doing to comply with the statute, and Congressman Massey and these other congressmen that are coming out speaking negatively about FBI Director Kash Patel and the Attorney General have no idea what they're talking about. They know the work that we're going through. They know what we're doing to protect victims. I mean, just think about what we're doing. You're talking about a million or so pages of documents. Virtually all of them contain victim information, Blanche said. With lawmakers out for their two-week recess, any potential action against the Justice Department will likely be delayed until early next year. But the issue is unlikely to go away, and questions about what has yet to be released are sure to swirl once Congress returns in January. Garcia made an open call for whistleblowers, urging anyone with information about the files to come forward. We know that there are hundreds of good Americans at the FBI and DOJ who also want to see justice for Epstein's victims and survivors, he wrote on X over the weekend, with the link to the tip line for the Oversight Committee. To anyone who worked hard on the files and is now seeing their work being hidden by their own DOJ, there are whistleblower protections. The story is The Hill's Morning Report, GOP split on Trump's Venezuela endgame. In today's issue, GOP skeptical on Venezuela goals, second batch of Epstein files released, Trump unveils new warships named after himself, Weiss defends pulling 60-minute segment. Republicans are divided on whether President Trump should increase military pressure to oust Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, with some pointing to the U.S.'s poor experience with regime change in recent decades. Trump has gradually ramped up pressure on Maduro, whom the administration has accused of facilitating drug smuggling into the U.S., conducting strikes on alleged drug trafficking boats in the Caribbean, and deploying warships, surveillance planes, fighter aircraft, and an aircraft carrier to the region. Most recently, the administration has begun seizing oil tankers that it says are carrying sanctioned oil, as Trump declared a blockade on all such vessels entering or exiting Venezuela. The president hasn't made clear what his ultimate goal is regarding Venezuela, but has refused to rule out any options. He has repeatedly signaled he would launch land strikes targeting drug production facilities soon and would possibly even send troops into the country. Trump also has said he believes Maduro's days are numbered. He told NBC News last week he wouldn't rule out war with Venezuela and that Maduro knows exactly what I want, declining to elaborate. The commander-in-chief's approach has struck at a divide within the GOP between a more traditional faction supporting a hawkish foreign policy and another camp supporting non-interventionist policies. The Hill's Alexander Bolton reports Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth told GOP senators last week that Trump isn't pursuing regime change, but some Republicans are skeptical, given White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles' comments to Vanity Fair, in which she said Trump wants to keep blowing up boats until Maduro cries uncle. Senate Republicans largely support Trump's tactics of targeting Venezuelan boats, but some argue attacking the regime directly would go too far. I think we just have to be very careful when we're dealing with regime change. It seems to backfire a lot, Kansas Senator Roger Marshall, Republican, said. Another Republican senator said they believe the administration is intent on ousting Maduro. I don't want to have another Iraq or Afghanistan, they said, referring to the wars in which the U.S. helped oust Saddam Hussein and the Taliban from power. Both situations quickly turned into quagmires that dragged on for years. Trump said Monday that would be smart for Maduro to give up power, but said it's up to him. But again, we're going to find out, he said. Meanwhile, Trump on Monday continued to ramp up his rhetoric against Colombian President Gustavo Petro, warning him to watch his blank and close alleged drug factories in his country. I love the Colombian people, Trump said, but their new leader is a troublemaker, and he better watch it. He better close up those cocaine factories. There are at least three major cocaine factories. We know where they are. President unveils Trump-class warships. Trump has once more made major item bearing his name, a new class of battleships he announced Monday. Trump said he approved a plan for the Navy to start constructing two battleships as part of the Golden Fleet, which the Navy said last week would protect larger ships from surface vessels and fighter jets. The ships would be equipped with guns, missiles, hypersonic weapons, and high-powered lasers. The president said the ships will take about 2.5 years to build. The military is expected to have between 20 and 25 of them. The ships are the latest item to set to bear the president's name. The administration has pushed to brand other buildings and initiatives after the president, including the new Trump Accounts for Kids, the U.S. Institute of Peace, and the Kennedy Center. Three things to know today. The Food and Drug Administration has approved an oral version of the weight loss drug Wegovy, the first such supplement approved for public use. Novo Nordisk expects to launch the pill early next year. The Trump administration has ordered almost 30 ambassadors to return to the U.S. within weeks. The New York Times reports all were appointed and confirmed during the Biden administration. U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon ordered Jack Smith's report on Trump's handling of classified and sensitive documents to remain private for now, giving the president 60 days to challenge its publication. Leading the day, Epstein files drop. The Department of Justice, or DOJ, early Tuesday released thousands of additional documents it has on Jeffrey Epstein, following up its first release from the end of last week. CBS News reported the latest drop that includes more than 11,000 files, including multi-page documents and hundreds of videos. It also includes court records, FBI and DOJ documents, emails, and news clippings. Many of the documents include references to Trump, including one that shows a subpoena that was sent to Mar-a-Lago in 2021 for records related to the government's case against Epstein accomplice Ghislaine Maxwell, the Washington Post reported. They also include notes from an assistant U.S. attorney in New York about the number of times Trump flew on Epstein's plane. Being named in the Epstein files is not itself considered an accusation of wrongdoing, and Trump has maintained that he broke off his ties with Epstein long before the convicted sex offender's arrest and death in 2019. Trump pushed back on Monday over photos released of people who he said innocently met with Epstein. He called the release of photos showing former President Clinton with Epstein a terrible thing. I don't like the pictures of Bill Clinton being shown. I don't like the pictures of other people being shown. I think it's a terrible thing, he said. Meanwhile, lawmakers are wrestling with what their next steps should be on the Epstein files. The Hill's Sudiksha Kochi and Rebecca Beich report that members of Congress are divided on how strongly to push back against the DOJ for failing to share all the unclassified documents it has on the disgraced financier. Representatives Thomas Massie, Republican of Kentucky, and Ro Khanna, Democrat of California, who led the effort to require the files release, have said they are drafting a resolution to hold Attorney General Pam Bondi in inherent contempt, fining her every day for the remaining files aren't released. Other Democrats have called for examining all legal options, but some have raised doubts about doing so immediately. Weiss backlash. Concerns are spiking among critics of CBS News editor-in-chief Barry Weiss about the independence of the outlet following her decision to pull a 60-minute segment shortly before it was to air. The segment was set to cover poor conditions inside a notorious prison in El Salvador, known as CICOT, where the Trump administration has sent Venezuelan migrants. But Weiss argued the segment wasn't ready for publication yet and had it pulled a few hours before Sunday's episode. Weiss reportedly requested several changes to the segment, arguing it also needed an on-the-record statement from the administration. But the correspondent who covered the story, Sharon Alfonsi, alleged in a note to her colleagues obtained by multiple outlets that the decision was political. Alfonsi said she reached out to the White House, State Department, and Department of Homeland Security, but didn't receive a response. She maintained that the story had been screened 5 times and had been cleared to air. Government silence is a statement, not a veto. Their refusal to be interviewed is a tactical maneuver designed to kill the story, she said in the email to her colleagues. If the administration's refusal to participate becomes a valid reason to spike a story, we have effectively handed them a kill switch for any reporting they find inconvenient. The decision to pull the segment marks one of the first major controversies for Weiss since she was tapped to lead the news outlet in October. She was appointed chief editor after CBS's parent company, Paramount, acquired her media startup company, The Free Press. Weiss has been a strong critic of mainstream media coverage, and supporters and critics alike have widely expected shakeups at CBS under her leadership. Questions about media independence and journalistic integrity arose earlier following Paramount's $16 million settlement with Trump over an interview with former Vice President Kamala Harris on 60 Minutes that aired last year, and the administration's subsequent approval of a merger between Paramount and Skydance. Lawmakers critical of Trump and his allies slammed Weiss's decision, arguing it demonstrates the president is successfully intimidating news outlets. What is happening to CBS is a terrible embarrassment, and if executives think they can build shareholder value by avoiding journalism that might offend the Mad King, they are about to learn a tough lesson, Senator Brian Schatz, Democrat of Hawaii, wrote on the social platform X. This is still America, and we don't enjoy blank like this. Weiss is standing by her decision, telling the New York Times in a statement that holding stories that aren't ready happens every day in newsrooms. She had said the segment will air once it's ready, when projects suspended. Senate Democrats are walking away from talks about permitting reform following the Trump administration's announcement that it's suspending five major offshore wind projects. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum said on Monday that the leases were being paused because of national security concerns. A press release from the department cited potential radar interference, known as clutter, from wind turbines, arguing it obscures legitimate moving targets and generates false targets near the wind projects. All five projects are located on the East Coast near New England, New York, and Virginia. The projects together would be expected to generate enough electricity to power 2.5 million homes, according to the project's websites. Democratic Senators Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island and Martin Heinrich of New Mexico said they will abandon long-running discussions about legislation to speed up energy and infrastructure construction unless the administration reverses course. They've been negotiating with Republican Senators Mike Lee of Utah and Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia on a possible deal for months. The illegal attacks on fully permitted renewable energy projects must be reversed if there is to be any chance that permitting talks resume. There is no path to permitting reform if this administration refuses to follow the law, Heinrich and Whitehouse said in a joint statement. Foreign drone ban. The Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, has banned new foreign-made drones from being sold in the U.S., citing national security concerns. The order prevents these products from being sold or imported in the U.S., but doesn't apply to technology that's already been sold in the country. The FCC made the decision in line with the 2025 National Defense Authorization Act, which calls for reviewing the national security risks that certain technologies pose. DJI, a Chinese company, holds a majority of the drone industry's market share. In the where and when, the president is in Florida and has no public events scheduled. The Senate will meet at 8:30 a.m. for a pro forma session. The House will convene at noon for a pro forma session. Revving up, the shadow primary for the 2028 Republican presidential race is showing signs of getting underway, with potential candidates' names gaining more attention. Erica Kirk, who took over as head of the influential conservative group Turning Point USA following the assassination of her husband, made a splash last week when she backed Vice President Vance for the GOP's 2028 presidential nomination. Vance hasn't publicly said if he will run, but has been seen as the de facto front runner in the Republican race to become Trump's successor. But The Hill's Julia Manchester reports that some cracks have formed within the conservative movement over who should take the reins from Trump after his term ends. Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, signaled he wouldn't back Vance, arguing the party has gotten away from its traditional values of free trade and limited government. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, has recently been reported to be considering another presidential run, enthused by a split with Vance on foreign policy. Rubio has also been seen as a possible heir apparent to Trump, who has praised his Secretary of State and suggested he might run with Vance on a ticket. Other names that have generated buzz included Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, Republican, and Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr. While Vance may be the early favorite, signs point to a competitive race for the GOP following next year's midterms. Heritage Exodus. More than a dozen staff members have left the Heritage Foundation and joined former Vice President Mike Pence's Advancing American Freedom, or AAF. The Hill's Emily Brooks reports Heritage Foundation President Kevin Roberts announced the departures internally in an all-staff email on Sunday, and AAF announced the hirings Monday. Heritage lost most of its staff from the group's legal and economic centers, while AAF is nearly doubling in size. We wish them well, though the manner of their departure speaks volumes, Roberts said in the email obtained by The Hill. The departures are the latest blow in the fallout, stemming from Roberts' defense of Tucker Carlson for interviewing white nationalist Nick Fuentes. Roberts later apologized, but staff had been growing dissatisfied long before the incident, as he has led the think tank in a more pro-Trump populist and non-interventionist direction. Conway Inn. Lawyer and staunch Trump critic George Conway has joined the increasingly crowded Democratic primary race to succeed Representative Jerry Nadler, Democrat of New York. A filing from the Federal Election Commission shows Conway, who co-founded the anti-Trump Lincoln Project after being a lifelong Republican, filed his candidacy on Monday. Conway had been married to former Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway before they divorced in 2023. George Conway left the Republican Party during Trump's first term and has consistently stoked the president's ire since then. The New York Times reported last month that Conway was looking to at a run. He's set to join a bustling Democratic field in New York's solidly blue 12th Congressional District. Other candidates include New York State Assembly members Alex Borres and Michael Lasher, Parkland, Florida shooting survivor and gun control advocate Cameron Caskey, and political commentator Jack Schlossberg, the grandson of former President John F. Kennedy. And finally, the Kansas City Chiefs appear set to move across state lines in the 2030s, as the team announced Monday it reached a deal to move to Kansas from its current home in Missouri. A council of top lawmakers in Kansas voted unanimously at the state capitol to allow the state to use more than $2.4 billion in bonds to cover 60% of the cost of a new domed stadium, a new training facility, and retail and entertainment space, the Associated Press reported. The bonds will be paid off with state sales and liquor tax revenue generated in the area around it. The stadium is expected to be built in Kansas City, Kansas, in an area near the home of the Major League Soccer team, Sporting Kansas City. It's expected to be ready to open before the 2031 season. The location of Chiefs games will change, but some things won't change, Chiefs owner Clark Hunt reportedly said after the meeting. Our fans will still be the loudest in the NFL. Our games will still be the best place in the world to tailgate, and our players and coaches will be ready to compete for championships because on the field or off the field, we are big dreamers and we're ready for the next chapter. The Chiefs are coming toward the end of their first losing season and first time missing the playoffs in more than a decade after multiple Super Bowl wins. The story is a column by Chris Steierwalt, a challenge for 2026, make yourself a little uncomfortable. For a short time in my life, part of every day's work was to call the U.S. Army Corps of Engineer to get the level of the Ohio River at the Pike Island locks and dam. Now even a basic AI model can get that kind of information, publish it, and offer a brief paragraph on what bargemen and boaters can expect and on relative flood risks. Artificial intelligence is proving to be, as most things in life, a mixed blessing for the news business. Jobs continue to be lost, particularly in the entry-level positions like the ones I had 30 years ago, that were basically transcription gigs, government meetings, sports corps, police reports, obituaries, etc. It's bad that these minimum wage positions that led someone like me get into the business continue to disappear. It's good that the work may actually still get done. America lost something like 26,000 newsroom jobs between 2008 and 2019, which followed a period of even more brutal contraction in the previous decade when online advertising shattered the industry and led to a purge of as many as 50,000 newsroom jobs. The brunt of that fell on small and mid-sized markets, where the work of basic news gathering and therefore basic accountability for people in powerful positions in these places often almost completely died out. Artificial intelligence is now bringing some of that back, allowing hollowed out newsrooms to restore coverage and lowering startup costs for news outlets. Unlike many sectors now being gutted by AI, the news business already had its catastrophe. News was among the first losers, so now it is among the first winners. That's very good. And in the hands of an experienced journalist, these data tools can help with projects that would have been infeasible, even in the heyday of the business. And there's the rub. Transparency and accountability are two related but very different things. Information has never been cheaper or more plentiful, but the things that matter are very likely to be lost in this digital ocean if they are not outright destroyed by the false or facile. The difference between what's available and what's useful are people who know where to look, which questions to ask, and what's important. And what's most important, indeed the principal reason for protecting the existence of a noisy, quarrelsome, factious, muckraking free press in our republic, is accountability. A free press, however annoying, is an essential check on power. But the cheap information and low barriers to entry that may help undeserved markets also means that where there's already a crowd, especially in big cities and for national news, there is a race to the bottom. In those markets that are oversupplied, particularly for national political news, the digital glut tends to drive quality down further. The incentives for those trying to build or retain a small share of a big, highly competitive market can be good if the winning advantages are about price, preference, and quality. That's great for most consumer products, but for news and information, it's different. With an advertising-based model, consumer costs are usually zero for a product that's available everywhere all the time, so preferences matter more. And it turns out that in news, what people tend to prefer is what they already like. We see how that works in entertainment. What consumers tend to want to watch or listen to is what they've seen or heard before, or products that are very similar. Of the 10 most watched streaming shows of 2025, according to Nielsen, only three, Bluey, The Rookie, and Squid Game, are from franchises less than 10 years old. The rest are all reruns or rewarmed versions of the originals. If you take comfort in rewatching The Big Bang Theory or enjoy turning your brain off to let Grey's Academy or NCIS distract you with a familiar cast and predictable storylines, there's no harm. In our house, 30 Rock is the default viewing option when picking something new. Just feels too taxing. But the news is supposed to be a little taxing. One of my refrains about the news business is that the difference between new and entertainment is that in this work, sometimes you have to tell people what they don't want to hear. Of course, that requires an audience willing to listen. And my colleagues, competitors, and I want to claim journalistic privilege. We had better, when necessary, be ready to tell our readers, viewers, or listeners things that they won't like. If we're hiding or contextualizing into oblivion the important or necessary facts, we're just content creators looking for some likes. But we can tell it to you gently. We can tell you with respect, but we have to tell you. The thing is, though, you don't have to listen. The two things people in our vocation should always strive to provide are, first, reliable information delivered in a timely manner, and second, our judgment about what is and isn't important. If we're doing the first part right, we will earn the trust and offer the second. An algorithm can serve up a waterfall of stories arranged to please consumers. A journalist is supposed to work for the chance to be troublesome or difficult as necessary. If you're a regular reader of this column or of The Hill more generally, you can make up your own minds about whether we are living up to the spirit of that charge. But from the inside looking out, I can promise that we are trying every day to live up to the line from Lord Byron once emblazoned on the wall of a newsroom where I learned the trade, without or with offense to friends or foes, I sketch your world exactly as it goes. I am sometimes failing, sometimes succeeding, but always trying. So, as this year draws to a close, I ask the same of you, not as it relates to what I write or what The Hill publishes. If you've made it this far in a column about the news business on Christmas week, I assume we already have your indulgence. What I'm challenging you to do in 2026 is push yourself outside the familiar when it comes to the news you use. Open yourself up to topics and opinions that make you a little uncomfortable. When you've reached a conclusion about a controversy, push yourself to find an opposing view. Not a straw man ready for torching, but a thoughtful and well-reasoned perspective. Seek out reporting that asks hard questions about the people and causes you are most inclined to support. Do this not too chiefly to support better journalism, though it will do that. Do this because it will make you a better citizen and a better partner in self-government with your fellow Americans, because you will be better able to see all sides of an issue. If we do our jobs and you do yours, wonderful things happen for our country. Steyerwalt is the politics editor for The Hill, veteran campaign and elections journalist, and best-selling author of books about American political history. The story: FDA approves oral version of Wegovy. The Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, has approved Novo Nordisk's oral version of the Wegovy weight loss pill, the first such pill approved for use. Novo Nordisk said in a Tuesday release that the GLP-1 pill is intended for once-daily use to reduce excessive body weight and maintain weight reduction long-term, and to reduce the risk of major adverse cardiovascular events. The company expects to launch the pill in the U.S. in early 2026. The FDA previously approved Novo Nordisk's Wegovy injection in August. The injection is intended to treat metabolic-associated steatohepatitis, a serious liver disease in adults with excessive scar tissue in that organ. Mike Duster, the president and CEO of Novo Nordisk, said in the release that the oral pill provides patients with a new convenient treatment option that can help patients start or continue their weight loss journey. In November, the Trump administration touted deals with Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly to sell their GLP-1 products at lower prices under its most favored nation policy. Under the agreement, oral GLP-1 pills that were under review will be sold at a starting price of $149 per month for individuals on Medicare and Medicaid, as well as those utilizing the Trump RX platform that is set to launch in January. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. called the move a lifesaver for those who cannot afford the drugs, but noted that his department will also address the root causes of chronic disease. A survey by the Health Policy Research Group, KFF, released in November, found that 12% of respondents are currently taking GLP-1 drugs for weight loss, though more than half of respondents said the drugs were difficult to afford. The most common side effects of Wegovy include nausea, gastrointestinal issues, vomiting, fatigue, dizziness, and low blood sugar, and those with type 2 diabetes, according to Novo Nordisk.